We touched upon early rumors that bishops of the Anglican Church, most notably Archbishop Richard Bancroft, may have altered as many as 14 places in the King James text before it was published in 1611. Olga S. Opfeld, Alistair McGrath, and Kenneth Fincham, among others, all discussed the possibility that these rumors originated with Miles Smith, along with Thomas Bilson. Saw the text through to the press in the print shop. I don't know why that is small, but it should say the King's printer, Richard Barker. In conclusion to this section in Lesson 185, I made the following statement. So this is how I concluded that section of the notes from Lesson 185. I said, quote, "Alleged textual tampering by Bancroft is discussed by many of the relevant sources commenting on the late stages of the translation process. It seems that Miles Smith's allegation of tampering on the part of Bancroft originated from within 10 years of the text first being printed in 1611. Despite these early rumors, the reality is that we simply do not know what readings, if any, Bancroft altered before he died in late 1610. That said, I do suspect that 1 Corinthians 12:28 could have been one of the passages that Bancroft changed before he passed." And then we had also previously briefly discussed that idea in Lesson 170, okay? Now, this is the life of a guy named Jesse, Mr. Henry Jesse. This is a document that dates from, I think, 1671. And I'm going to just type this in because we want to find the Bishop of Gloucester. So here is another document, okay? And a lot of this is coming from this document. So let's look at this phrase right here, okay? So I'm right here where it says mention. It says mention might be made by some of some unhand, some dealing, not in the translators, but in a great prelate of that time, the chief supervisor of the work. That would have been Bancroft, okay? Who, as the Reverend Dr. Hill, we looked at Hill's sermon last week from 1648, in a great and honorable assembly, would have it to speak prolectical language, and that to end altered it in 14 places. To that end, altered it in 14 places, many of which he instanced, weird old way of saying it, as Easter or Passover, Acts 12:4, bishopric or charge in Acts 1:2, hell or grave divine service or institutions of worship. And then he talks about Hebrews 9:1, neither the text or margin answer to the original. And he talks about Diana in Acts 9:13. And then notice this statement right here. Indeed, those and such like alterations were not only against the minds of the translators. So is he clearly saying that the chief supervisor of the work altered the text to speak proletical language in ways that was not in the minds of the translators? And what Jesse is doing is what the author of this is doing is then referencing Hill's message sermon that we looked at last Sunday from 1648. Okay, then notice right here. We're not only against the minds of the translators, but of then Bishop of Gloucester, that would have been Miles Smith. Miles Smith became Bishop of Gloucester in 1614, I believe, who was joined with the other as a supervisor and complained of it to a friend and minister of that country, but he is so potent, he said, that there is no contradicting him, okay? So this is where this is coming from. This is from 1671. Is he clearly talking about Bancroft? Is it referencing Hill's message? Is it talking about stuff being changed and the Bishop of Gloucester, who would have been Miles Smith, complaining about it? Okay, so this is where this is coming from, all right? So let's go back to the notes. Last week, we continued our discussion of this topic by looking at additional information from the Gibson Papers. Now again, I showed all of you here in class before I rolled this tape the actual image of those papers that is not licensed for public release. But all of you in the room here have seen it. Unfortunately, I cannot show it to the live stream audience or put it in the notes, a photo of it, because I do not have permission to do that. Okay? So last week we continued our discussion of this topic by looking at additional information from the Gibson papers in the possession of Lambeth Palace Library, in which we find the following statement regarding Dr. Richard Brett, who served on the first Oxford Translational Company. Quote, Dr. Brett reported that bishops altered very many places that the translators had not agreed upon. He had a note on those places. According to another report, Archbishop Bancroft himself insisted upon certain changes being made in a few places. So guys, do we have a stacking here of some evidence to suggest that there were early rumors, that people knew what some of these things were? Guys like Hill are talking about what some of the places might have been, okay? Lawrence M. Vance, B.F. Westcott, and Charles C. Butterworth all cite this document slash statement in their respective works that we quoted in Lesson 186. Recall that I have seen a photo of the handwritten document in the possession of Lambeth Palace Library, but I'm not at liberty to share it due to copyright restrictions. So all of you in the classroom right now, you've seen it, except for Bart. I don't think you were here yet when I showed it. But I've showed you that image, and we looked at the spot where it clearly talks about Dr. Brett. I just showed you, okay? Next, we investigated Dr. Thomas Hill's sermon, which, by the way, is that mentioned here, right here, the Reverend Dr. Hill, okay? Next, we investigated Dr. Thomas Hill's sermon dated April 3, 1648, in which he addressed some of these rumors. Recall the following general statement. This is from Hill, quote, I have it from certain hands, which has lived in those times, that when the Bible had been translated by the translators appointed, the New Testament was looked over by some of the great prelates, men I could name some of their persons, to bring it to speak prelatical language. And they did alter, as I am informed, by the means of one that was a great observer in those times and lived them, 14 places in the New Testament to make them speak the language of the Church of England that was so cried up, and I'll tell you some of them, okay? So you guys are remembering this, right? I know you all have photographic memory of everything that we talked about last week, okay? So, in doing so, we looked at the six examples offered by Dr. Hill, one of which was 1 Corinthians 12:28. Which we spent the most time discussing in Lesson 186. My comments on Dr. Hill's sermon in general and upon 1 Corinthians 12:28 specifically caused some stir online this past week, as I suspected they might. Now, how many remember when I said, when I went through this, that some people were going to lose their mind? Remember that? Okay. So that appeared, some people clearly did not necessarily like what I was saying. Most notably is Nick Sayers of Revolution Church. Most notably, Nick Sayers of Revolution Church in Australia created a YouTube video titled Some Thoughts on Brian Ross's Video About Bancroft's 14 Changes, in which he expressed his misgivings about the content of Lesson 186. So here's Brother Nick's video from Revolution Church in Australia, and here we can see a nearly three-hour video of him going through my one-hour lesson from last week and offering his thoughts about what I had to say. So if you want to, there's a link here in the notes. If you want to listen to what Nick says and compare it with what I taught, by all means, feel free to do that, okay? This also prompted discussion on Nick's Facebook group, Texas Receptus Academy. Interested parties are encouraged to click on the link above to Nick's video and check it out for themselves in light of Lesson 186. In addition, I received a couple of emails from concerned citizens, and some comments were posted on our YouTube video by Brother Christopher Yetzer, okay? So I knew that dealing with this was going to cause some people to, you know, I don't know what the word is. I'm trying to be charitable, but they weren't going to like it, okay? because it's not necessarily, it's a little bit different from what most people traditionally within the King James only space have said about some of these things, okay? But there's a lot of evidence here that suggests that from very early on, from the mouth of Miles Smith, the Bishop of Gloucester, we saw in the piece there, right here, from he's mentioned specifically, then Bishop of Gloucester, which would have been Miles Smith. Miles Smith became Bishop of Gloucester in 1614, and he died in 1624. So that's within 10 years of when the 1611 first appeared, okay? So again, so before moving on, I'd like to clarify the following regarding my use of Dr. Hill's sermon in lesson 180, should say 186, okay? First, I was using Hill's sermon in conjunction with Dr. Brett's comments in the Gibson papers as data points to substantiate the rumors of textual tampering on the part of Anglican bishops during the first half of the 17th century, up to and possibly including Archbishop Richard Bancroft. Guys, is there a swath of voices here that are all saying this happened? Okay, so we can either acknowledge it, talk about it, see if there's any validity to it, or we can pretend like this doesn't exist. My preference is to look at it and dissect it and see if there's anything to it, not to just ignore it, okay? Number two, second, Dr. Hill mentioned Thomas Bilson by name in his paragraph on Acts 2. It is unclear whether Bilson is one of the people referenced two paragraphs earlier when Hill mentioned, quote, prelates who amended the text to speak, quote, proletical language. Now, we already saw that quote, guys. If you flip back to page one, you've already seen that quote from Hill. Third, I never said that I agreed with all of Hill's examples or even that they were good examples. Okay? In fact, I find many of them confusing and hard to follow. My explanation in lesson 186 was designed to try to explain what Hill was arguing in his sermon. I was trying to explain to you what Hill was saying. I was not, therefore, trying to say that I agree with everything Hill said. Okay? Lastly, I do think there is strong evidence to suggest that 1 Corinthians, that should say 12:28, was altered by someone before it was published in 1611. I'm working on a separate document in which I lay out all of my reasons for thinking this. So since last Sunday, in addition to everything else I've got going on, I have started working on this document right here that I'm not prepared yet to share publicly, but it's 1 Corinthians 12:28 debate, and I am making a timeline with links to various resources as well as embedded photograph images, okay? So this, for example, is the 1560 Geneva Bible. You'll notice helpers, comma, governors. You'll notice there are marginal notes, R and S. If you go here, notice the note on helpers says as deacons, and notice that the note on governors represents as elders. Completely consistent with what I was saying last week about the divide in England at the time between the Anglican view of the episcopacy, church politics, and the Puritan view of church politics. As a Puritan Bible, are the are the guys who are doing this from Geneva clearly saying that helpers and governors are two different things and clearly tying them in the margin to deacons and elders. Okay? So we've got that. I've got the picture here from the 1602 Bishop's Bible. I have the picture of the verse from manuscript 98, where we can see that it had helps, comma, governments intended. And then all of a sudden here, I also have the pictures from the notes of John Boyce. And then all of a sudden in 1611, we have helps in governments, like we talked about last time. And then in 1629, it is fixed. And so I am dealing with a bunch of primary source citations related to discussion of 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 28 in this greater conversation. And I'm not done with this. When I am done with it, I will anticipate making some sort of a video going through the document, okay? So, like I thought would, and I just closed something. Apparently I didn't necessarily want to close, but whatever. like I thought might be the case, some didn't like what I had to say, right? So if you want to hear what they think, go check it out. You can, I have the link right here to Nick Sayers' video. You can go listen to it for yourself and compare it against what I said, okay? Now, before we move on, does anybody have any questions about all that? So that was a 20-minute introduction related to stuff that we've already done, but I felt like I needed to bring everybody up to speed on what has happened since last class.
It seems like from 1611 to 1629, when they changed it back, there must have been a lot of people that were really wanting to change that, because that's a short time.
Yeah, and I would argue, so I guess I will go to this document. Here's a statement from a gentleman named Henry Burton in 1640. He cites the 1611's reading on 1 Corinthians 12:28 as supporting the episcopacy. Notice what he says, quote, which our English renders helps in governments, caps, added the caps for emphasis. And all this according to the express law of Christ our King, recorded in the scripture as being the most perfect pattern of the government of his church for every particular congregation to be relegated and ordered by. Is he in favor of the reading? Does he think the reading is teaching the way the church government should work? And is he quoting the 1611 reading helps in governments? So my point is, guys, like, listen, there's a lot more going on here than just what I had time to cover last time, okay? Then we can look at Thorndike from the next year, 1641. Thorndike cites and argues against the 1611's rendering. He says, quote, that is helps or assistance to the government of presbyters, so that it is not to be translated helps in governments, but helps, comma, what? So does he view it as a printer error, or does he view it as an intentional reading? I the way I read it is he views it as an intentional reading. The guy before him, did he view it and say this is the way it should read? So here we have again the arguments that are happening. We could go to 1641, George Gillespie. he's bothered by the 1611's rendering and argues against it. He says our fourth argument is drawn from 1 Corinthians 12:28. So he's quoting it, okay? Where we find again an enumeration of sundry offices in the church, though not so perfect as Romans 12, and amongst others helps, look it, that is deacons. Is he adopting the understanding set forth in the margin of the Geneva Bible? He is. He's, that's exactly what he just said, right? Let me go back down. And amongst others, helps, that is deacons, and governments, that is ruling elders. That's exactly what the 1560 Geneva Bible said. I just showed it to you, right? Okay. Then he goes on, where we cannot enough admire how the authors of the New English Translation were bold to turn it thus, helps in governments. So to make one of two, and to elude our argument, the original hath been clearly distinguished, and I find some late editions of the English translation to have it as it is in Greek, helps, comma, what? So is he saying that now there's some that have fixed it? You guys follow what I'm saying here, okay? How this change hath been made in our English Bible, I know not. And then in the next paragraph, Gillespie says, quote, Christendom hath, Chrysostom expounding this place doth not take helps and governments to be all one, as who? Bilson hath boldly but falsely what? Now look, guys. Who is he mentioning has argued that they're all one thing? Bilson. Who, with Miles Smith, saw the thing through to the press and the print shop of Robert Barker? Bilson. Is Bilson mentioned by name by Thomas Hill in his sermon from 1648? Okay, so like, at what point is there substantial evidence to think that, you know, one of these guys could have done this in such a way? And by the way, Bilson preached a sermon and wrote a book in 1593, before the Bible Project even started, where he argues for the episcopacy and uses 1 Corinthians 12:28 to argue that it's all one thing, exactly the way it reads in the 1611. Okay, so again, at what point do we take it? And there's a bunch more stuff here that I'm including in this document. I probably have already said too much about it. It's not available yet online because I'm not done with it. But I think you can see that there's more to this than what I had time to cover last week. Okay, now that everyone is thoroughly bored, any questions before we move on?
Did they make those changes to go along with their beliefs, do you think?
So, let's say all this is true. So, let's say what I'm presenting is true. Yes, Bilson, possibly Bancroft, would have altered it to, and this is what Hill says, to make it speak the language of the Church of England. That's what he says. So, that would have been an alteration in 1 Corinthians 12:28 that would have absolutely made the text speak the language of the Church of England against the Puritan view of church governance, which clearly identified helps and governments as related to deacons and what? Elders. Exactly like the foot and the marginal notes in the 1560 Geneva Bible say. Okay? All right. Enough of that. That was already 25 minutes of that. So, no, that's not your fault. Like, so I feel like I need to cover that because, you know, what I've said has come under some fire and some scrutiny, and I feel like I have to at least address it to some degree, that there are more reasons for why I think what I think about this than simply what I had time to cover last week, okay? Now, and I am admittedly not done with that document laying out more things in this conversation that should be considered. So, next point. Time permitting, we will consider the following points in the duration of this lesson. We're going to look at confronting the copyright myth, and then we're also going to look at, which I don't know if we'll have time to get to, a brief look at early 17th century printing. Okay. All right, so let's get into the copyright myth. So I forgot to do this, but I was going to grab a copy off the bookshelf in the front, a copy of my book, The King James Bible in America. What I'm going to say in this point is taken from what I argued in that book. There's a whole chapter in that book about the copyright myth and what has been said historically by King James advocates related to copyright issues and so forth. So let's look at a few things. So bottom of page 2. Let me just say, do you think that every Anglican bishop was pure as the driven snow?
No.
Do you think that that none of them could have possibly, to their advantage, saw an opportunity to alter anything to suit their purposes? They are in a position of power. I'm not saying they're all total evil, maniacal people, but if they had a chance to do something, should we rule out that they were somehow super uber spiritual and they never would have done that? I, for one, am not willing to rule that out because I know how people are. Even the most well-intended people, if they have an opportunity, will they occasionally fudge something in their favor? Okay?
Yes.
I'm not willing to say that they never could have done that or they never would have thought to do that simply because they were involved in the process related to the King James Bible. Okay? I think they could have and they possibly did based on a swath of evidence that we've gone over. Okay? So, confronting the copyright myth. The question of whether the King James Bible is or was ever copyrighted is a perplexing one for modern King James only advocates. It is commonly repeated in pro-King James argumentation and literature that the King James Bible resides in the public domain and was therefore never copyrighted. This is used as a rhetorical device to score points against modern versions, which most certainly carry modern copyrights. Okay? So the way the argument goes is something along these lines. I'm paraphrasing and playing the role here. Well, the King James was never copyrighted. The NIV, the ESV, etc., these are all copyrighted. These are for-profit Bibles. Therefore, they're bad, evil, and corrupt because they have copyrights on them. The King James is pure and great and no problems because it was never copyrighted. So I'm overemphasizing that just a little bit, but this is an argument that you will run into, okay? So I'm going to say to you at the bottom of last sentence of page 2, argumentation such as this is only partially correct. It's partly right and it's partly wrong, okay? I devote an entire chapter of my book, The King James Bible in America, an Orthographic, Historical, and Textual Investigation, to, quote, confronting the copyright myth. So this next swath is me quoting from my book where I cover this topic, okay? The King James text resides in the public domain in the United States, okay? This is certainly not the case, however, in Great Britain, where the authority for printing the authorized version is vested in the Crown, okay? Now, if we go to Blue Letter Bible, just as a case in point, it's waiting on the internet here. If we go here and let's just look at Matthew 24:35, just pick whatever shows up first based upon one of my recent searches. And if we go down to the bottom of the chapter, you'll notice the following statement, okay? The authorized version, or King James Version, 1611, 1769, outside of the United Kingdom. The King James is in the public domain. Within the United Kingdom, the rights to the King James are vested in the Crown. Is that still true? Mm-hmm. Still true. All right? So go back to the notes. The King James text resides in the public domain in the United States. This is certainly not the case, however, in Great Britain, where the authority for printing the authorized version is vested in the Crown. Even the popular internet-based Bible research website Blue Letter Bible, which we just looked at, acknowledges this fact by including the following disclaimer at the bottom of every King James text, bottom of every page, excuse me, of King James text. Quote, outside of the United Kingdom, the King James Version is in the public domain. Within the United Kingdom, the rights to the King James Version are vested in the Crown. So that's this statement right here that I just showed you, right? Outside of the United Kingdom, next paragraph, the authorized version entered the public domain after the Revolutionary War. Okay? Before the Revolution, were the colonists all beholden to the Crown?
Yep.
Yes. So did they have the authority without express Crown permission to print the text in the colonies?
No.
They did not. Okay? Outside of the United Kingdom, the authorized version entered the public domain after the Revolutionary War. These facts run contrary to the standard narrative within the King James only movement. The right or privilege to print the King James text remains under the Crown's authority in the United Kingdom to this day. Moreover, when these facts are followed to their logical conclusion, a different and far more instructive narrative emerges. English law does not view the Crown as owning a copyright or other intellectual property right in the authorized version, but instead having the duty to ensure accuracy in its printing. Okay, now let me explain. Those books out there that I wrote, they are copyrighted. Who owns the intellectual property in those books?
You.
Me. Okay? The Crown does not own the text, What the crown has, by English law, is the custodial authority over the text to see that the text is printed accurately. That's what they have. It is not the same as a modern understanding of copyright. Let's go on. With respect to the authorized version, quote, the king did not own the Bible as intellectual property, but rather had the duty to ensure accuracy in printed Bibles. Consequently, the crown's responsibility was to ensure that the text of the Bible was printed accurately and with fidelity. The crown discharged its custodial authority by limiting slash controlling who it bestowed with the privilege of printing the text. You following this? So who owned the custodial, whose job was it to see that the text was printed accurately with fidelity? The crown. Okay? So that in order for, so does that mean that anybody willy-nilly in Britain could have printed it? It's not what it means. Did you have to have express written permission from the crown to be allowed to print the text? So that is not a modern copyright, the way we understand copyright today, but is it a limitation on who has the right to print it? Okay? where do we leave off? It is precisely?
Yes.
Excuse me. It is precisely on account of the fact that the British Crown possessed the right to grant or deny printing rights that the King James Bible exists in its current state, exhibited by Oxford and Cambridge Printings, more than 400 years after it was first published in 1611. Possessing custodial oversight gave the crown the authority to decide who would be granted the privilege of printing and thereby limited the number of people impacting the text. Okay? Thus, British printings were limited to only crown-approved printers in primarily four locations: London, Oxford, Cambridge, and Edinburgh. Far from being a detriment to its printed history, the Crown's custodial authority has helped maintain the level of textual consistency exhibited by the modern printings put forth by Oxford and Cambridge University Presses. So this is a hard thing for people to understand. Okay? Is this... This is not a copyright in the sense of the king... Somebody have a tissue? Can somebody grab me a tissue, please? I hate to blow my nose on camera, but the sniffling is probably worse. So pardon me for a second. Sorry about that. So my point is, the crown is limiting who can print the text. So are they limiting how many hands are in the cookie jar? As they limit how many hands are in the more hands that get into the cookie jar, the more opportunity you have for variants and crazy stuff to be printed and published. And the fact that the crown is limiting who is able to print is keeping the variants, is keeping the discrepancies and the differences in the text to a minimum, because they are not just throwing open the door to anybody to print it. Okay? In this country, could Grace Life Bible Church open a print shop and print our own copies of the King James Bible on our own press? Yeah. Yeah, because it's in the public domain where?
Here.
Here in the United States. So what I argued in my book, The King James Bible in America, is once American printers began publishing the text, did you start to see an increase in more different readings creeping into the text, different spellings, different this, different that, because American printers sought to Americanize the text. Okay? And by the way, the first Bible in America was not printed until during the Revolution, because they did not view themselves as having the authority to do it until then. And of course, during the Revolution, they're in the process of breaking away. And because they're fighting the British, the Bibles coming over from the mother country completely dried up. And people that wanted a Bible were now looking to the Continental Congress to try to solve the problem of lack of Bibles. But again, there's a lot to talk about there that I discuss in the book that I don't have really time to get into here. Look at the next point. The title page for the New Testament found in the original 1611 bears the following inscription in Latin at the bottom of the page. Cum privilegio. Translated, these Latin words literally mean with privilege or with right. That is, with right of reproduction. Okay, so let me show you that. All right, so you have a picture in your notes. I'm going to scroll to page 5. Here's the title page, the New Testament title page of the 1611. You can see right here, 1611. And then down here at the bottom center is the Latin phrase, cum privilegio. What does that mean? So had the crown granted privilege or right to print the text to Robert Barker, the king's printer? Mm-hmm. So could Joe Schmo print the text?
No.
Who could print the text? Only those who the crown had granted what? Privilege to do so. Are you following this?
Yeah.
Okay. So with these facts at bottom of page 3 now, with these facts in mind, please consider the following points. First, it is an historical myth to maintain that the King James Bible was never restricted / controlled in terms of its printing because it remains so to this day in its country of origin. Second, far from being detrimental to its textual history, the very fact that the printing of the King James Bible is a privilege bestowed by the British Crown has resulted in the British printings being preserved nearly verbatim over time, while many non-substantive textual changes have appeared in printings outside of the United Kingdom. You following that? So if you pick up a printing from America from the early 1800s, you will see words spelled different than they were spelled in the British printings, because the American printers were Americanizing the spellings of what? The words for their American readers. Those are the kinds of things we're talking about here, okay? The Crown's, next sentence, the Crown's approved printers were not at liberty to alter the text without leaving themselves open to penalties for doing so. So not only is it a falsehood that the King James text was never controlled, it is this very reality, i.e. the reality that it was controlled, right? It is this very reality which served to ensure the uniformity of the text as it traversed the seas of time and history. The standards utilized by local church Bible publishers to prepare their booklets were the text published by Oxford and Cambridge, both of which published cum privilegio, or with privilege, without the crown's oversight of the text. One wonders if the twin standards used by local church Bible publishers to judge all of their printings would exhibit the remarkable degree of conformity that they possess, or whether they would exhibit the variety found in the American printings of the King James. On this basis, any comments regarding the King James Bible being in the public domain need to be restricted to printings in America or other parts of the English-speaking world outside of the jurisdiction of the British Crown. So then, page 5, you have the image that I showed you a moment ago that's still on the screen. Let's go to the bottom of page 5. While Robert Barker possessed the sole privilege / patent for printing the text, he did so at considerable personal expense. Top page 6. Printing the King James Version was an expensive undertaking, not least because Barker seems to have had to pay the enormous sum of £4,000 for the right to the translation. Now think about that. If he's paying £4,000 for the right to publish, does he want 6 other guys in London to have that?
No.
Not at that expense, okay? He financed the project by selling or mortgaging shares in the office of the King's printer to 2 rival printers, Boehm, and John Bill. The names of Barker, two Nortons, Boehm and his cousin John, their Bible, and their descendants were to appear on Bibles for generations. Because the King James Version was classified as a revision rather than as a fresh translation, it does not appear in the register of new books known as the Stationer's Register. In the absence of a date in the register, we are left without any knowledge of when, in 1611, the King James began to be sold. So we don't know exactly when. I'll have more to say about that in a future lesson. The popular notion is that it was published on the 2nd of May, is often repeated, but this is a myth. There is no such thing as a publication date in the 17th century, and there is no evidence to link the King James Version to May or any other month, and that's according to Gordon Campbell. Okay? So, any questions about the copyright situation? So I had a lot more to say about that in that chapter of the book if you're interested in obtaining one. Okay? So, we still have some time. Any questions? All right, we'll keep going into the second point then, which is a brief look at early 17th century printing. Dr. Donald L. Brake, author of A Visual History of the King James Bible, offers an interesting summary of the printing process as it existed in 1611. He says, quote, "It is difficult to assess how many Bibles may have been printed in Barker's first run. In 1540, Henry VIII ordered a great Bible placed in every church in England, and while the King James Version was not directly appointed to be read throughout the kingdom, it was authorized for reading in British churches, a fact that argues for the version's broad acceptance, at least by Anglicans. Charles Ryrie suggested as many as 20,000 copies were printed. Adam Nicholson, author of God's Secretaries, proposes that 20,000 copies of a 1540 Great Bible were printed at the cost of 10 shillings each, or 12 shillings, if the copies were bound. A little more if they were bound. However, he is quick to point out that no record has been found to establish with certainty the number of copies of the King James Version printed or at the cost per copy. Barker's legendary financial difficulties, which led him to unhappy union with business partners, seem to suggest that a first printing of 20,000 may be an excessive estimate. Since a new printing began soon after 1611, it is questionable that the initial run of 20,000 copies would have sold out that quickly. As mentioned earlier, a run of 1,500 may be more realistic. No organized attempt to destroy Bibles and Barker's printing of Geneva Bibles at the same time would argue for a far smaller run than 20,000. So understand what he's saying. Is the same print shop also putting out Geneva Bibles? Okay, so this isn't the only Bible that he's putting out. After all, there are only 150 copies that survived. So we only have 150 copies of an original 1611 that we still know of. Yet in spite of Barker's financial struggles, he published a smaller, more conveniently sized quarto edition of the King James in 1612, adding further mystery to the number of this first print run. So we don't know when it first appeared, we don't know when it first began to be sold, and we don't know how many were in the first printing, as far as number of volumes. When modern scholars examine existing copies of the 1611 King James Bible, they find it challenging to reconstruct the exact print and collation process. They have discovered that, among other things, reprinted pages, corrected pages from one edition often appear in later editions. But how did this occur? We do know that the printer did not immediately bind the books as they came off the press. Leftover pages were stored until the market demanded additional printed Bibles. When orders were received, individual pages were taken from shelves, collated, bound, and sold. Remaining pages from one edition were often bound with subsequent editions, since the printers were more concerned with convenience than with maintaining a pure translation. But some people are going to be upset about that. So that statement is from the point of view of the printer. Okay? If the printer makes 100,000 copies of a page and he only binds, say, 90,000, is he just going to throw away the remaining 10,000, or is he going to store them and try to reuse them in the next printing? Mm-hmm. So what ends up happening is you end up with some printings that have like mixed pages. Some older pages and some newer pages get mixed into some of these printings, okay? To add to the confusion, print shop formats of the period commonly set presses page for page. Barkers often used formats that began to end at exactly the same page where large black type folios, page folded once, Roman quattros, page folded twice, and Roman type octavios, page folded three times. I'll talk to you more about that in a minute. This practice allowed pages to be inserted into Bibles from one typeset run to another, creating a high risk of mixed copies, pages from one edition or corrected edition of the Bible inserted into another edition. Okay? So in other words, what you end up with in some cases is older pages mixed in with newer pages into a bound edition because of the way this was happening. A second 17th century printing practice most likely accounts for at least some of the mixed readings scholars have identified. Proofreaders corrected pages as they came off the press. Literally, while the presses were still rolling, as a result, mixing corrected and uncorrected pages during the storing and collating of pages were inevitable. And while the above-mentioned scenarios are undocumented and somewhat speculative, so he's acknowledging that they're somewhat speculative, they are rooted in historical knowledge of printing practices of the day and provide an account of the mixed readings in other shorter passages and leaf pages of the folio edition of the King James Version. Several additional complexities made matters even more intractable. Multiple editions of the Geneva Bible may have been in various stages of print while the King James Version was being typeset and printed, exponentially increasing the possibility of mixing print runs. Also, multiple presses most likely operated in multiple locations. If this was the case, how did Barker determining whose office was responsible for proofing and printing different portions of Scripture? What system was orchestrated to implement consistency among multiple sites? And in a revealing observation that attests to the business pressures of Bible printing from the earliest days of the King James Version, Norton states that Barker often pre-sold books before they were completely printed to pay for the supplies and personnel costs. So that was a common thing, to sell things in subscription, because that's how they raise money in some cases. So you pre-bought it, and you paid for the section you were pre-buying, and then the printer would take the money from the sale of the subscriptions and then use that money to print it and pay for the personnel that needed to run the presses, etc., in his shop. Thus it is impossible for us today to gain more than a clouded picture of what occurred during the 1611 printing. While some of these statements from the pen of Dr. Brake might seem overly speculative, they provide context in seeking to understand what transpired when we look at the actual first edition of the King James Bible printed in 1611. In a later work published in 2017, Dr. Brake offered different numbers for how many volumes were printed in the first printing of 1611. Quote, some have suggested only about 1,500 to 2,500 copies were originally printed, a common number for first runs. To the author, this seems more likely, since the Barkers were in financial stress and a second print in 1613 came so shortly after the 1611 printing. With no organized attempt to destroy this edition of the Bible, its large folio size designed for pulpit use, and with about 195 to 200 extant copies today, the number of 20,000 originally printed is probably incorrect. Is everybody following with this?
Yep.
Okay. So before moving on, we need to make sure that we understand the words folio, quattro, and octavo. These words are referring to the size of a printed book. Okay, so I have a diagram for you on page 8. Okay, so a folio was typically 12 inches by 19 inches. An octavo was typically 9.5 inches by 12 inches. I'm sorry, a quattro. And an octavo was typically 6 inches by 9 inches. Okay, now last year I brought this book to church. This is something I picked up, The Making of the King James Bible. This is Edward Willoughby's famous monograph. And within here is a page from the original 1611. And I brought this to show you the size. Okay? This is a folio page. So this is the largest size. The 1611 was only printed in folio size. So this, you can see, is basically the size of this book. This is like what we would call a coffee table book. This is not a Bible that is designed for personal what?
Use.
This would have been a pulpit Bible in a church. So the first 1611 edition was only printed in folio size. So when you see those sizing figures there and that diagram, this is what we're talking about. So the 1611, look at the next point. The 1611 was originally printed in folio size. In 1612, both quattro and octavo sizes of the King James Bible were published. So those, if you look at this, are those going to be more of a personal Bible? So the folio editions of the 1611 are pulpit Bibles. Now imagine having a book this large with as thick as the Bible is. That's a big book. Okay, what's that?
My mom and dad had one that big.
There were family editions sold in the 1800s. Do you still have it?
No.
Oh.
You wouldn't want it. It was a Catholic version.
I still would want to look at it as a historical artifact, but
we had another one.
So,
on the different sizes, is the same text on each page, just in a smaller version?
This is a folio size, and this is what is called black letter font, or what was representative of a Gothic font, similar to a Gothic font. The next year, in 1612, the printer makes two more sizes, and he also puts out an edition in Roman font, which is a totally different font. So, ask me your original question again.
Is it the same amount of verses on each page, depending on the size, or does that change?
So, it's a great question. I don't know the answer off the top of my head.
I was thinking you might want a version depending on your eyesight, too, if it's bigger and easier to read.
Well, I hear what you're saying. I don't think that was necessarily a consideration that those people had back then, the way people... So now can I go to the store and buy a giant print Bible intentionally for people that have bad eyesight? The main objective here was not to make a large edition for people who had bad eyesight. The main objective here was to make a pulpit Bible that could be read from in the church. Then the next year, 1612, he puts out two smaller editions. So you can see the sizing comparison here between the folio, which is the big size, okay, the quattro, and then the octavo. So the reason I put this in the notes is so that you can understand the size and comparison. And then if you go to the next page, there's a chart there of how the pages are folded to create each size. So on the folio size, you're taking the paper and you're making one fold, and it's a big page. On a quattro, it's a quattro because you're folding the paper. So you end up with four separate pages out of the larger piece of paper. You following that? And then the octavo is obviously named because you fold it 8 times and you end up with the 8 folds produce 16 pages. So obviously you can get more pages out of one piece of paper when you fold it more times. So I don't think, Bart, I don't know, I'm just going to speculate. I think that the folio editions probably do not necessarily match identical to the smaller editions that are put out in the next year as far as where each page stops. Because I just don't see how, with folding it that many times, to create a quattro or an octavo, that you could make that happen, unless you just so condense the size of the font. Okay? Is everybody following this? So I do want to finish this since we started this. Should be able to do it. So I'm on page 9 under this diagram. So again, if you want to know more about this, I put this in here for you to study or look at if you want to. So beginning in 1612, Barker printed complete King James Bibles in three basic formats. Okay? There were the black letter quattros. So black letter is this style font. Okay? Looks more like a Gothic font, but it's called black letter. So there were black letter quattros, Roman type quattros. So that's a different type face, different typeface, and Roman type octavos. A.S. Herbert recorded these editions as follows in his Historical Catalog of Printed Editions of the English Bible, 1526 to 1961. So there were Roman type quattros. So if you look at this list, so 1612 saw two printings of Roman type quattros. Also in 1612, there are two printings of Roman type octavos. So now, by 1612, you have three different sizes. You got the folio size. Do you have the quattro size and the octavo size? And are they available in a couple different fonts? Okay. Now here's the thing, though. Now imagine having to keep straight three different sizes in two different fonts. So when Brake was talking about how it was easy to get things kind of end up with editions that had maybe old pages with new pages, etc., it's because this I just can't even wrap my mind around how maddening this would have been, just from a book creation standpoint, to keep all this stuff straight. This is before, obviously, word processors and modern printing, etc. All this stuff, this page had to be typeset by hand. Every page of the Bible now in three different sizes with two different typefaces. All right? It's amazing there weren't more typos and stuff and printer errors than there actually were. So meanwhile, I'm almost done. Meanwhile, 1613 saw the publication of the first black letter quattro edition. So that would be this font in quattro size, not folio size like we have on this piece of paper. Okay? So by 1613, so 2 years into this, by 1613, there were three different size editions of the King James Bible in print. Large folios, quattros, and octavos in two different fonts, black letter and Roman type. As we will see in a future lesson, each of these editions introduced their own unique printer errors and variants. Okay? So we are a little bit over time. I'm a little surprised I accomplished all of this, especially with the additions I made in the introduction. Does anybody have any quick questions or comments before we end the live stream and pack up the equipment?
One question I have is the new revisions that are out there, what exactly are they getting a copyright on? It seems like you're stealing somebody else's work and making a couple changes and saying, this is mine. Is it just the changes that they copyright, or what are they getting a copyright for?
So, to put it more practically, what, for example, what is the NIV copywriting versus the ESV? So there's a lot of stuff that is said online and in social media about that. Like, for example, you have to make X number of changes before you can get a new copyright. That is a thing that is commonly said at the popular level. Obviously, there's an element of truth to that, but I think there's more involved in it than just simply saying, okay, we're going to make X number of changes between an ESV and an NIV, and now we're going to get a new copyright. Obviously, the ESV and the NIV differ, and they don't, they read differently, etc. But I think there's more to securing a copyright on a new Bible than to simply make X number of changes. And by when I say X number of changes, no one knows exactly how many changes one would have to make to get a new copyright. I think it's more involved than just that. But at the popular level, that is said a lot. And I understand why it's said, because obviously if you just read an NIV and an ESV, they're making different changes and they're saying things differently, right? So I understand why people say that. I'm just not convinced that there's not more to it than that. Okay? Any other questions? So I'm going to probably bring this back. If anyone wants to look at this page, one of the reasons why Willoughby's monograph was only printed in like less than 300 is because each one contained an original folio page from a 1611. So, any other questions? All right, we will close up.